You're listening to Have Mike Will Travel with Elizabeth Santry.
Hey, welcome to the show. Today's guest is Darla Jackson, and she's a very talented sculptor and the owner-operator of the Philadelphia Sculpture Gym. She gave me a tour of the gym, and we sat down and we talked about things like leadership, how to make time to create, and learning from the perspective of a teacher. I really hope you enjoy the show. Thanks. All right. Well, I really appreciate that. It was a pretty awesome tour. I thank you for having me here. This is the Philadelphia Sculpture Gym, which is your baby.
Yes, it is. Most assuredly.
So this came out of like grant writing, essentially. You had to pitch for this support, right?
Yes, it really came out of a suggestion more so, because what happened was that somebody said, oh, here's this great thing that just came to Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. You should apply for it. And I said, yeah, sure, why not? Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit bigger than a tweet. It was 160 words was the application.
Is that really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so,
I didn't realize. Well, what I really want to know is, I would love to know if you could like bring yourself back to the moment that you thought of this, thought of the idea, because I love the sort of that those seconds, those moments where inspiration really hits. Like, just because what interests me is there's a theory that when creative thinking actually is when you're not thinking. Mm-hmm. That's the only real way to when you're disconnected. So like, what were you? Some people come up in the shower when they're riding their bike, whatever. Like, what was the? Do you remember the moment you had this idea?
It's just been this ongoing thing, because with sculpture, you always need somebody to either have the equipment that you don't have, or you need to have it yourself, and it's expensive. And so it's something that I feel is just this universal problem across the boards with people who need equipment that's too expensive to get themselves. And so I would run into that continually. And it's something that I'd talked about with lots of people, mm-hmm. but then at this moment when, and what do I apply for this great idea in the arts thing? Like, well, wait, what about the shop? What about the group shop?
So it's this obvious idea staring you in the face.
Yeah, and I was just like, oh, there it is. Okay, yeah, let's do that. And so I wrote this 160-word proposal that I ended with, like, you know, keeping people safe so they don't, you know, cut their fingers off or right. something like that. And just remember being like, oh, my God, they're never going to ever go for this. And I became one of the finalists and had no idea of the context of it. Was just like, okay, yeah, I'm one of many individuals. And it turned out that I was one of very few individuals in a world of big players in the art game. So it was like the Barnes Foundation, the PMA, and the African American Museum, and Fairmount Park Art Association were among finalists with me. So I was like, oh my God.
Okay. Yeah. And is this, I mean, because you've been an independent artist for a good couple of years.
Yeah.
Does this feel like a legacy, or does this feel like one of many projects you're going to take on in your career?
I feel like it is, that's a good question. I feel like it could be either, depending on how much weight I put into it. As long as I still have time to make my own work, I could see doing both of those things kind of sidetracking each other.
So you have a boundary, so to speak. You have a mental boundary. As long as you can achieve this, some other aspect of your life is working, then you'll continue this.
Yes. Okay. And if it starts to interfere and take away from the time I need to do my art, it's, you know, the art is the most important thing to me, and this is a place to make it and a community, but I can't let the place to make the art get in the way of actually making the
art. Right. I think that's important to have that boundary.
Yeah.
So, so how long has it been? It's been a couple of years now.
Yeah, so I got the grant in 2011 from the Knight Foundation, and then got the building in early 2012. Mm. We worked on the space to get it up and running, a group of volunteers and really dedicated people, and we finally opened in 2013.
Okay, see, I want to pick apart these little moments.
Yeah.
When storytelling, people are expressing their story about how they achieve something. What tends to go over my head, it's like, you got the building. It's like, for me, I'd be like, and how does one get a building? Like, you know what I mean? It just, you say it so quickly and so nonchalantly, and of course, you're just telling a story, but what does that even entail? Like, this is what I want to do with the show, is pick apart and get some realness,
right,
and some detail, some meat to these stories. Like, how does one get a building? That seems like a huge feat.
It is kind of a huge feat. So there was lots of buildings, and I looked at tons of buildings. And, you know, this one was too much. This one had a creepy landlord. This other one had, you know, no door that was big enough to get a sheet of plywood through. So it's like picking out the little things that would work and not work. And then I drove by this building all the time, and the number of the building is the same as my house. And so I was like, why haven't I looked in there?
Yeah.
And so I came in and met with the landlords, and we're walking around, and the building was a shithole. Covered with literally dog poop everywhere on the floor. Right. There's like broken down cars throughout the space. There's just like piles of rubble and like old, you know, pieces of cars and massage equipment. And I don't even know what was going on. So I saw it and I said, this is it. I love this. And everyone thought I was insane.
Right.
And so it took, you know, months and months and months and months of like emptying out the space to make it look like it does now. But it's, I saw it in that first shit-filled visit.
You must have to get used to people calling you insane when you're doing big risk projects.
I guess I'm getting more used to it, but it is, the more I think about it, it is a level of insanity. And, you know, you can say it nicely as like taking risks. And, but it is being slightly insane. If you think too hard about every obstacle you will meet in any given situation, you will stop yourself immediately.
Yeah. So how do you do that? Do you just, have you just let go like of focusing on obstacles and just sort of wing it when they show up? Like,
yes, I feel like I've always been a really good big picture thinker. Like, I can look above the horizon and kind of see the larger view of things. And then if I focus on the little stuff that's going to trip me up, I get, you know, sad.
I don't
want to be. So I like to focus big and kind of stay positive. And I think that being undyingly positive, even when it's not realistic, is really helpful, because, you know, it gets you through some things that would trip a lot of people up.
Right.
And if you focus on the negative, it's just, you're going to get stuck there and beat yourself before you even try.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about success and, like, what that means to you. I think it's a really subjective term. I guess we can do, like you were saying, big picture, small picture. So we can take this project, and that'll be the small picture of, like, what is successful, like, what does success mean here at this studio? And versus what just means success to you in life?
I think in terms of the space here, right now it's all volunteer run, myself included. And so if we got to a point where myself and a few other people were able to, you know, make a full-time living working here for the space, either as the space itself or as artists in the space doing side jobs and projects for people, that would be a really good benchmark of success, because creating a space for artists to be successful in terms of making it as an artist, quote unquote, is something that's really important. So it's not just a space to come in and like sling plaster around and weld stuff together. It's a space to come and make things that can, you know, give you the chance to get paid for what you want to do in life, what makes you happy. So being an artist. So having real concrete lives being made off of money being made here would be success in a box for me. And in terms of success in life, I mean, I feel like for me it would be just being balanced as a human being between all the areas of my life and being able to do what I love full-time, which would be make my art, to be able to support this space through making my art and just being here as a person who can guide it or whatever. And then just having, you know, a really healthy home life with my daughter and just feeling, you know, nourished and like just together.
For sure. So you've got the space, and then you just mentioned your daughter. I'm assuming, I'm not sure if you're going to have able to chime in about travel. I love to talk to people about travel. And I don't know if you're really genuinely tied down to the space and to family. Do you have do you daydream about travel? Do you think of any places that you can go? Like, does your art give you the opportunity to travel?
I actually just called my mom today, and I told her that I would love to go with her and my daughter to somewhere far away in Europe, preferably. Mm-hmm. I'd love to go back to Italy. Mm-hmm. I went there years ago and was completely inspired, and it mm-hmm. started me off in a whole new direction with my work. I don't get to travel for what I do, and yeah. I would love to more, because I feel like it's one of those things that I've always been tied to Philly for some reason or another, which I love it, yeah. but I think that going away from it and coming back to it with new eyes is,
yeah.
you know,
I mean, I bring up travel great. Because I hear so often, and it's for me as well, about how inspiring it can be and how yeah. refreshing, and I think maybe it's just change of pace, change of mm-hmm. space, but how rewarding or just exciting and refreshing it can be yeah. to a creative mind. So you said home life. I love to ask people about their sleeping habits and stuff. But with kids, I'm sure it can be hectic, but so what's that? What's your disconnect, chill out, sleeping, taking care of yourself kind of practices that you do?
I try to get out of the sculpture gym at a reasonable time, mm-hmm. and I have my daughter 3 nights a week, mm-hmm. and so on the 4 nights a week that I don't have her, I usually stay here until 11, we close, I go home, and recently I watch MasterChef until I can decompress, and then I go to bed, and I try to, you know, get up with the sun and do something of value beforehand and before I pick Olivia up.
Okay.
And so that decompression time, regardless of what it is, sometimes it's something silly like TV, and sometimes it's like, you know, more calm, like just sit and sketch and whatever.
Right.
But yeah, and then with Olivia, it's, you know, she wants me to read her a million books and fall asleep with her in bed, which normally I do. So.
And do you have her here enough to see, like, the day-to-day, enough to...
In the space,
to,
yeah.
She's, enough for her to, like, articulate what it is to be an artist, to articulate... I mean, you've got some heavy machinery around here, and to know what those tools even do.
Yeah.
Does she at a point where she knows all this stuff?
I mean, Olivia has probably seen more bronze, aluminum, and carbon arc iron pours than the average human being.
Right.
And she's rammed her own Lumalume molds, which is what she calls aluminum.
Yeah.
And she really does. She has her own tool set here. She has her own locker. She has her own little safety glasses that have like a pink
that's awesome.
Dot on them. And she said to me, you know, I want to grow up to be an actress or a paleontologist. Mom, what is that? But I want to be one.
Yeah.
Or
sounds awesome.
A sculptor. And I was like, oh, that's great. Fit us right.
Yeah,
paleontologist
right.
and actress. But yeah, she definitely sees what's going on. And I think it's really important for kids growing up in a creative environment to see what the possibilities are. And it's been really awesome.
So how, speaking of kids, how were you as a kid? What kind of kid were you?
I was really creative and adventurous. We grew up in kind of the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, so mm-hmm. I was always running off into the forest if I could, and I loved doing that, you know, always drawing, always sketching, always doing something, but also very, like, normal, you know. It mm-hmm. was a small town, and everybody knew everybody.
Okay,
and,
okay.
But... Yeah, and then I came to Philly to go to art school, and so I feel like certain things broadened a little bit for me when mm-hmm. I came here, but I still feel like I have that kind of small-town mentality. Like, mm-hmm. I like everything to be really tight-knit and really close, and
okay.
I feel like this place is that, and
okay.
so it's kind of a recreation.
So you're building a community as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
And what do you... I was going to ask you about how you handle, like, creative block.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could tie in, I don't know if this community that you've built around you helps in that process, if you're an outward seeking for when you are blocked, or do you go inward?
I generally tend to do a little bit of both. So when I get stuck, talking through ideas that I have really helps. And this place is great because there's plenty of people to bounce stuff off of. And
mm-hmm.
usually they're nice enough to tell you whether or not it's a shit idea or not. And which
is invaluable information.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's good. And then sometimes I just need to, you know, retreat away from everybody and
right.
then just draw and draw and draw and draw and write and write and write. And sometimes
okay.
it's just like, you know, I'll just absorb as much information as I can. It becomes like almost obsessive, like
okay,
I'm watching
right,
every
right.
movie I can and looking at everything.
Yeah.
And like sometimes it'll be like one line in a song that'll just like get me going again.
Okay.
And like just the most random act of something. Like I spoke to somebody a few years ago that had this song that he was playing, and he was like, I'm working it out, but there's something about teeth in the ocean, and I just thought of barnacles, and I was like, barnacles, barnacles on things and making and da da da, and so I sculpted
yeah.
this bird that had barnacles on it. It was
yeah.
this very weird like juxtaposition of things
right.
that don't normally
exactly.
go together, and it just kicked off this whole flurry of
It was a series?
Still in the progress, but definitely it's, you know, it was great because it was just some one creative person saying something that just sparked something.
That's another thing about influence. I mean, do you find that there's like the influence of other people working around you? Do you see like a flow and an ebb of people kind of vibing? You know, do you see like I guess you call them like ocean waves, so to speak, but like certain sort of energies happening in the studio?
Absolutely. I think it's this definite back and forth between people, and so sometimes more than others, but one person will see somebody doing something and it's like, whoa, what's that? What are you doing? How did you do that? Mm-hmm. What is that for? How can I do that? And so you'll see people trying stuff out that they wouldn't normally try or just kind of getting into something that was a little outside of their comfort zone because they saw somebody do it and that person explained it to them. And then, you know, you see people going from that back into what they're used to, and everybody will kind of like, you know, do their own thing and then come together. And it's, I do the same thing. Like, I worked on a giant bear out in front of everybody in the classroom. And then, you know, a couple months after that was done, I was like, okay, now I'm building a studio that has a door on it so I can shut it when I want to. Because being on view in a fishbowl all the time is awesome sometimes. Right. But other times I'm like, I need to hide in my studio and cry. And I just don't want everyone to see
me do
that.
The process.
Yeah. So that's part of my creative process, and I need to be able to do that in private. I don't want to have to hide under my desk in my office.
Would you consider yourself to be an alpha or a beta personality?
I would say alpha, but not like aggressively so.
Okay. It can be like a percentage. It doesn't have to be like a black and white kind of answer.
I think it's I don't know. I'm very aggressive in terms of going after things that I think are important or you know, just, and especially when like defending or fighting for someone else. I'm definitely like, yes, let's go for it. So definitely alpha in those cases. But then there's times where for myself, I'm less likely to be as aggressive in certain ways. But, you know, when it comes to things that I want, like, you know, making my art, like I'm aggressive about having time for that. And I'm aggressive about just things that are important.
Yeah. What's the, I'm just curious on a gender level, like what's the quotient here, the ratio I should say, of
I would say
male, female?
It's 75% male and 25% female, and it's kind of fluctuated, and that's right now. When we started, I feel like it was about 50-50. Our monitor rate, those are the people that volunteer for the shop, I think we're at 50-50 now, so it's 50% female, 50% male. But yeah, it varies. And so it is nice though, because you see sometimes like there will be badass ladies in the welding shop doing things, and there's, you know, men in the jewelry shop making like beautiful bracelets and stuff. Yeah. So it's like, it's a nice space to see that everybody's here doing something, but sometimes it's still, even within that, there's the opposites of what the societal norm is. And it's nice to see that.
And are you doing any outreach or trying to expose like, and if you are, what kind of message are you putting out there to try to attract people here? Like, in what tone of voice are you reaching out to? Because you're essentially the voice. I mean, you're the, you know, the creator of this. Like, what kind of tone of voice are you reaching out to people?
I really try and do it in a way that is welcoming to everybody. And so I really want to make sure that people feel like they can come and, you know, not have any experience or have very little experience and be kind of welcomed in this group and start to be shown how things work. So it's very like positive and kind of empowering, I guess. You know, we've had people come in that have never made anything in their lives and come in taking a welding class and walk away with something and like, I just stuck metal together with fire. That was awesome. So it's it really varies, but I feel like it's, you know, we are about making stuff here, and you can come in and make stuff. And it's
so awesome. At one point, you, I don't know if you still are, but I know for a fact that at one point you were teaching.
Yeah.
And do you still teach?
I do. I teach at Fleischer. I teach at some colleges in the city, and then I teach here too.
Okay. And I guess one thing I'm curious about is, like, teaching to a certain extent is like performing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I love to ask performers about, you know, the days that they're not into it, and how do you pull it off, and like, where does it come from, the motivation and the, just to get psyched up to do something and to try to excite other people. And it's a big responsibility to, you know, take the whole floor, everyone looking at you, and then having something to say, have something valuable to say. You know, how does teaching How does it wear on you?
Well, I feel like I go in and out of phases. So, like, sometimes in a semester, I'll feel so excited. And usually it depends on the group of students. If it's okay. an awesome group of students, it's very easy to, like, stay psyched up the whole time. It's like, yeah, you guys are excited. I'm excited, too. This is amazing. But then if it's people who are, like, skeptical or just, like, not as into it, it's sometimes it gets very draining. And the way that I deal with it is I'm like, okay, we're just here to sculpt. I'm going to sculpt. And so it goes from so much performing outwardly, talking, and you know, to just doing. And so I'm at that point, I guess, more teaching by them seeing how I'm doing things, and if they ask how I've done something, or if I see something that, you know, this is pertinent, let me say it out loud how I did this.
But what's interesting to me that you would have a disinterested student. This isn't like it's high school or it's obligatory. How do you have someone who's paying for a class who's not interested?
I wonder the exact same thing sometimes.
Well, like, seriously, I mean, break it down. Like, what do you really think that is? Do you think it's just they're intimidated and they're afraid of trying something? Because you know what it is? I know for myself, and I'm sure everyone feels this way, I hate doing something for the first time.
Right.
That awkward process of, you know, of how it can look and appear, and, you know, it's not going to be
good
great.
At it or not, yeah.
Well, what do you think is going through people's brains?
I think that I mostly see it happen when it's newly entry-level college-age students. And it's that
so it's a maturity factor, you think, maybe?
I think so, because, I mean, but I've seen kids that are that age that are, like, far and above.
Okay.
So it's a very certain group of kids, I guess, and it's just they come in and they're just not there. They're not taking it seriously. Like, oh, I'm in art school and I'm just going to do whatever I want. And I think some of it came from, like, them all being the best artists at their respective high schools, and then they come in with this ego and like, yeah, I don't really need to, like, oh, this is beneath me or whatever.
Oh.
And I don't think that's the case. I think that anybody can learn something from anyone, and it's you should always put your all into what you're doing. And I see it too in the art practice. There are people that come in here, you know, and just kind of slock around and don't really focus, and they want to be here every day, but they're too busy, like, going out drinking or going to go out with their girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever.
Right.
And just, like, if you want to be serious about art, you have to dedicate time to it. And so it's a frustration when people wonder why they're not making it as an artist. I'm like, yeah, but you're never in the studio. Like, what did you make last year, week, you know, month, whatever? And
well, what was your turning point like? Because you know, and I, this is one thing I hope to bring up in throughout the series, is because so many people wonder when they're really excited or talented at something, when is the right time to switch to full-time and really put it all out there, risk-wise? You've got financial risk, you've got emotional risk, you've got so many risks, and it's petrifying, and so I'm very sympathetic to that, and I would love for that story to be told by people. And I remember when you were, you know, making the switch. Can you talk through about, like, what were you thinking at the time? If you were ready, how much doubt were you dealing with? Or were you just loaded up on confidence and ready to go? I don't know.
I think it was all of the above, but it ended up being, you know, you're doing something that you have to for a day job, and you don't have a choice because you have to make money. And you are doing something you love in the off hours and fitting it in between every other thing, and that feels almost sometimes like an like a burden, because you're cramming it in and like, oh God, I have to go to the studio. And you're like, no, I love going in the studio. And when it started feeling like that, when it started to feel like too much of a burden to go there because I was working my real job and I was too tired, I'm like, wait, my real job is not my life. This is my money. I can be a waitress for a couple days a week and make just enough money to be an artist or something, you know, whatever. And I had, right around that time, got asked to do this big commission, and so I was still working full-time, doing a commission, exhausted, and, you know, just deliriously tired, and I realized that I can't do this anymore. Something had to change. And so
I'm impressed with the awareness to recognize. I think it would be an easy mistake to make to think I should probably cut back on the art, because the paying the bills, you know, that kind of mindset is, you know, because everyone so likes to be tapped into quote unquote reality about doing what's right. So I'm impressed that you know, saw it, you perceived it as an actual threat to the bigger picture.
Oh, which is totally. And it continues to be for lots of people.
Yeah.
It's, over the last few years, I've been you know, had less money than I've ever had in my entire life, but I'm still managing to do it. And it's,
right.
There's ways around, you know, I've cut back on certain bills, but I still eat out too much.
Right,
and I, you know, do stupid things, and I'm not a great saver, and I, you know, whatever, but I've managed to make it work. And so there's always, I feel like if you're industrious and, you know, aggressive about, you know, needing a situation to happen to help you get through a rough time, you can find it. You know, I've done side jobs for people. I've made molds for people. I've made art. I've had weird little art sales. The last show I had, I raffled off the whole show just to do something different, and it ended up working out for me well. So it's just trying different things all the time to make ends meet, or to just be doing what I love, I think is more what it is. So it's, I'm able to do this and still be able to pay the bills by doing it.
Now, do you have a connection to Philadelphia in a way where I'm wondering, do you think this could work in another city? And I mean, and now you might be speculating, and that's okay to speculate. I want your opinion. It doesn't have to be, you know, number crunching facts of whether or not this could work in Chicago or work in LA or work, but like, what is your gut telling you? Like, do you think what you're doing and the approach that you're taking to this community sense and what you're providing to this community, do you think it would work in another city?
I feel like this is needed everywhere. So yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I know that there are other like maker spaces in some of those cities. Like there's I3 Detroit, which is a...
But I mean you, like you, the way you do
it. You mean
it.
As an artist or
like... I just mean like the Darla approach, that uniqueness. But you know, I mean, I'm not branding you, but do you know what I mean? That unique perspective that you have. I think reminding ourselves on a daily basis that we do have a unique perspective, and that, you know, and embracing that. So like the way this is functioning, like that's what I'm looking for, because of course, like you said, this is a very simple idea.
Yeah,
you didn't necessarily invent it.
No.
But you had the guts to do it. That's the real thing to cherish.
Yeah.
And if do you think this community is, you know, is unique to Philadelphia? I'm just wondering.
Well, I mean, I guess in some aspects I feel like yes, because I feel like Philly is a very friendly art town. Like we all
kind of
want to help each other, and that I think makes it different, where I think lots of other places are more cutthroat and, you know, just not as friendly. But I feel like within any community there has to be people that are like this, you know. And so,
and well, the one thing I notice is the willingness to try, you know, and try something that you don't know, and practicing different things, different disciplines, different mediums, and trying. People do a lot of different things. So that being said, is there other things outside of sculpture that are rewarding, as, you know, whether it can be like a form of meditation and relaxation, or just a totally different interest of yours that maybe people wouldn't necessarily know about?
One of the things I've been doing recently to decompress is yin yoga, which I also call hold me like a baby yoga, because that's what it feels like.
I don't know this one. Please tell me.
It's like longer poses and you hold them.
I actually have done that.
Yeah. So relaxing. And
I never heard the name. That's why I was a bit thrown off. Sorry.
Yin is great. Hold me like a baby yoga is my own personal,
You actually, they can be quite painful because you're churning up a lot of energy in holding it for a while. Like, I've experienced that where it was just like, it felt like an eternity.
I love it. I don't know why. It's like, it's so calming to me. I feel like, I think probably because every day I feel like I'm just going. And so that I'm just still for so long, it just feels completely amazing. And, you know, if I do acupuncture and yin yoga in the same day, I feel like I'm just in a wellness coma for like the rest of the day.
That's fantastic.
And, I mean, that's been super helpful. And
do you get a lot out of acupuncture?
I feel like I do. I started it when I was pregnant with Olivia, and then I stopped the day I had her, and then didn't start again for 4 years just because I hadn't had the time, and noticed a difference almost immediately in just certain issues.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I feel like I do community acupuncture, so instead of it being a solo person, it's less expensive.
I was gonna say, is it cost effective?
It's sliding scale, so it's like $15 a session.
Right.
And Philly has at least two places that I know of. There's Barefoot Doctor Community Acupuncture, which I go to on Girard Ave. It's awesome because it's inexpensive and you just get to take a nap and have pins put in your head.
And in a group, did you say?
Yeah, so you're just in chairs, like reclining chairs in one room.
Oh.
And so it's, you know, people come in and out, and
yeah.
You have to be okay with just like being in a chair with your shoes off in front of other people, but it's, you know, unless you snore, like the worst thing is going to happen is you're going to snore if you fall asleep. If you're okay with that, you're cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's nice. And I feel like it's kind of the same thing, some similar aspects to here. It's just like taking something and making it cheaper by making it accessible to more people at once.
Which is super relevant right now.
Yeah. And it's like everybody's doing this thing and it makes so much more sense. We all don't need to have our own lawnmower and, you know, table saw and acupuncture place.
The sharing platform, I know what you mean. Because, I mean, look at it. Like, we are pack animals.
Yeah.
I read this really interesting article the other day, which I thought was really, like I said, interesting, is that rejection. Rejection actually can feel, apparently it registers in your brain similar place as physical pain because, and so that's why, like, breakups or being fired, all these things really do cause some really intense pain for people, and that it, you know, to be sympathetic for it because we're pack animals, that the rationale as to why is that you needed to be in the group, you know, back in those early days, and that if you weren't, you wouldn't survive very long.
Right.
So it was almost like a kick in the butt. Like if you were doing some type of antisocial behavior that would lead you to be rejected from the tribe,
then cause physical pain.
And it would remind you to get your shit in order to get back to the tribe to be welcomed in because it was a survival thing. And and so I think that's really interesting in that we are so community-based. And so these sharing platforms, I mean, even car shares and bike shares, they're one of the older ones that have been going on for like 10, 20 years now. But we food shop in groups. We go to movies in groups. We, you know what I mean? We do so much in groups. I think that it does make perfect sense to weld in a group.
Yeah, and it's like, you being an artist in your own studio by yourself can be so isolating. It's, some people need that and some people want that.
Right.
But it's just, there's no energy that's bouncing off of other people. There's no fresh eyes looking at your stuff unless you invite them in. So then you've already picked someone that you know is going to potentially look at it in a certain way. So it's not just anyone walking through is going to say, that looks like a, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that some of the best synergy that happens here is just people that happen through and like, whoa, what are you doing? Hey, I know a guy. He has a thing. You should talk to him.
I love when that happens.
And it's amazing. It happens here like almost every freaking day.
Yeah.
And it's almost too much sometimes. I'm like, all right, I've met so many.
You're right.
Guys has got other guys. I got guys. We're good.
Right.
But it's the best part, you know, of this.
So I want to talk to you about, last thing I want to ask you about is, from what I understand, like, you know, animals have always been, you know, within your work and sort of that Aesop fables, you know, making parables and connections and metaphors and all that sort of stuff. Where does that come from? Like, when did you know that this was, I mean, it's still a theme, yes?
Yes, okay. Definitely.
And when did that moment occur that you thought, this is the language I want to use? I want to use animals as my language.
I was doing both figure and animal sculpture and using a lot of symbolism and, like, using animals as symbolism, like, this represents this, and still combining it with the figures. And people would walk by the figures like, oh, that's, you know, that's nice, or da-da-da, or just like, ugh,
yeah,
weird.
One reaction and or the other, I get it.
With the animals, they were so cute, but I always have this kind of cute and dark twist, and so people would be like, oh my god, it's a cute little rabbit, but what is that weird crow mask on its face? And so it was this, like, they would be drawn in by this form that's recognizable, and it's not a human, so they're not like, yeah, whatever, just another figure sculpture.
Okay, okay.
But it's like, oh, it's a cute rabbit. Like, right. I feel like people let themselves go with animals, some people, more than other people. So, you know, you'll see the biggest guy walk up to a dog on the street and be like, hey, you little cute puppy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it was some sort of that going on. So people were, like, opening up to my art a little bit more because it was some bizarre little animal.
So you're seeing it working.
Yeah, and then
I have a theory.
Yeah,
I have a theory that I think deep down, no matter what level of understanding you have at art, I think deep down secretly everyone wants to be able to get it.
Yeah.
And they feel really good when they get art.
Yes.
And there is a I don't think I'm going to be able to say that word correctly, so I'm just going to back down. There's a universal trait to, like you said, to animals. There's this, you know, like approachability and all that kind of stuff. And so, but I think that, but I also think that it's also credit to you that you make really sound, I don't say obvious, but clear metaphors that you can get it.
Right.
You know, and I think people love to feel like they're in on it with you.
Absolutely. And I'm making art for the general public. Like, I'm not making it for other artists. I'm not making it for, you know, anyone in particular. I'm making for everyone. And so I want someone to be able to come up and appreciate it either like, okay, I know that that's this and it looks good and I like it just for that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the posture of this baby deer feels so sad and I've felt like that before and I know, like, it's this empathy. And so it's like trying to draw out this empathy in people. And it, I am talking about things that are universal emotions that, you know, kind of like what we were talking about earlier, you know, this happens to everyone, and I want you to know that I feel this way too, and you can tell me that you feel this way because you're seeing that I feel this way, so now we're having a conversation about how we feel based on something you saw that made you feel a certain way.
Right.
So it is weird that people kind of open up more over these animals, but I have found it to really work for me.
Cathartic for the viewer and the maker. That's really cool. Well, again, I really appreciate your time. This is really is a fantastic space. It's really approachable, but yet really serious. Because I don't know how any of these things work, and I think it's really cool.
I'll show you.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks again. I appreciate it, darling.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to show your support through comments and reviews.